Hello, this is the Journalism Explainer, the podcast series that tells the backstories of journalism's reinvention. And welcome to our special World Press Freedom Day episode. I'm Julie Pizzetti, joining you from the Finnish capital Helsinki, which is host to UNESCO's global conference celebrating World Press Freedom Day on May the 3rd. It's the UN Day gazetted to tackle threats to media independence and the lives of news producers around the world. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the Windhoek Declaration on Press Freedom Principles and the 250th anniversary of the first Freedom of Information laws, which covered the modern territories of Finland and Sweden. I'll be speaking at the UNESCO conference about the vital importance of the protection of whistleblowers and journalism sources, based on a study I've authored for UNESCO called Protecting Journalism Sources in the Digital Age. It examines source protection in 121 countries. So let's take a deep dive into the issues. I recently anchored a panel discussion about the study, which is soon to be published in full, at the International Journalism Festival in Perugia in Italy. Celebrated German investigative journalist and author Marcel Rosenbach from Der Spiegel, prominent US journalist and academic Professor Dan Gilmore, and the groundbreaking UK investigative journalist and author Heather Brooke joined me there to discuss the study and the way forward for investigative journalism as the threat to confidential sources increases around the world.
So I want to take you through the findings of the UNESCO study. I worked with a team of, I think, 11 or 12 research assistants around the world. Interviews were conducted with close to 100 experts. Surveys were done globally as well. This is a mass collection of data which is designed to try to map the status of legal protection of journalist sources around the world. As I said, it essentially examines the shifts that have occurred between 2007 and 2015. The middle of 2015 was when the research stopped, and we had a review panel which has been examining the findings as well. There is an examination underway in UNESCO of the report. Dan sat on the review panel. So the headlines are here. The legal frameworks that support the protection of journalistic sources are under significant strain. We also are facing a situation where increasingly the laws that do exist are at risk of erosion and restriction and compromise, representing a direct challenge to the established universal human rights of freedom of expression and privacy. And that especially represents a threat to the sustainability of investigative journalism. So one of the recommendations, one of the key recommendations of the study, is that there's now a need to revise source protection laws where they exist to ensure that they are updated, to reflect the challenges of the digital environment, and to introduce them where they do not yet exist. There's also a recognition that acts of journalism need to be shielded from targeted surveillance, data retention, and the handover of data by third-party internet intermediaries, the internet companies, if you like, related to confidential sources in the context of investigation. So these are the headlines. But to bring it back into the real world of journalism, let's think for a moment about what happened this past week. We had a historic data dump, biggest data dump in history, according to people who are working on the project, the Panama Papers. 2.6 terabytes of data was released by an anonymous whistleblower. Not even the journalists closest to this whistleblower know the identity of this source. And as you are probably aware, the source made it clear that they would only, he or she, would only deal with the reporters working on the project through encrypted messaging. So these are a very relevant facts to this study, the role of encryption and the need for the preservation of anonymity or confidentiality when it comes to sources. There are other examples, recent examples, that highlight the seriousness of these issues. We had in 2015 a revelation which is very familiar to my colleague from Der Spiegel, that led to the CIA revealing the identity of a source, as reported by other news organisations, to the German government. And the result of those revelations was reportedly the removal of the source from a high-level role within the Chancellery to a role involved in working in the archives. So there are real-world consequences for sources when their security is compromised, and that can happen increasingly through surveillance, mass targeted, and through data retention and so on. There's also examples recently from Al Jazeera. We know, as Der Spiegel again reported in 2013, that the NSA had intercepted and read the internal communications of Al Jazeera journalists that had been encrypted, in fact, by the news organisation. We had revelations through the Snowden documents that the GCHQ, the British Intelligence Service, had revealed or had siphoned emails, rather, from some of the top news organisations in the world, from the BBC, The Guardian, Le Monde, Reuters, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. So there are many examples throughout the world. I suppose one of the more potent ones is one that happened in Macedonia earlier last year, when a former opposition leader revealed that he had evidence that 20,000 citizens had been subjected to unauthorised surveillance, and among them were 100 journalists. And Deutsche Welle reported at the time that the journalists were invited to the opposition party's headquarters and shown documents full of transcripts of their communications with their sources. So this is not paranoia. This is verifiable, documented, risk associated with communications in the digital era. We also know that journalists have been identified in a threat hierarchy alongside terrorists in connection with the Snowden papers. That was one of the communications revealed. So the key findings of this study, which looked at, as I said, 121 countries, were that 69% of these countries demonstrated developments that were essentially negative developments regarding journalistic source protection in the period that we looked at. You can see the screen demonstrates where the greatest number of shifts occurred, notably in the Arab region, Latin America, then the Asia Pacific, Europe and Africa. We also found that without the substantial strengthening of legal protections and limitations on surveillance and data retention, investigative journalism that does rely on confidential sources is going to be increasingly difficult to sustain, and that's a pretty worrying development. The issue itself now is mapped as intersecting with the issues of mass surveillance, targeted surveillance, data retention, legislation that requires the retention of data for periods of time, up to 2 years and longer in some countries, anti-terrorism and national security legislation, and the role of these third-party intermediaries, which are the internet companies. We found that there is a need for transparency and accountability regarding surveillance and data retention, and that is critically important if sources are to be able to confidently make contact with journalists, as happened in the case of the Panama Papers and many other investigations. And journalists are increasingly adapting their practice in an effort to try to shield their sources from exposure. But threats to anonymity and encryption, and there are attempts by governments around the world to challenge the legitimacy of encryption, for example. And there are certain governments which attempt to, prohibit the right to anonymity as well. These are factors that undermine those attempts. But examples of journalists changing their practices include going back to analogue basics, doing the sort of deep throat approach of meetings in dark car parks. One of the editors that I interviewed in Argentina talked about sending an investigative journalist 3 hours, 4 hours in a car on dirt roads to avoid detection, to meet a source for 15 minutes and turning around and coming back. These are the sorts of extreme measures that journalists are going to. But as we saw with that example from the source in the case of the Pentagon Papers, there are high-level sources who wish to make contact through electronic means, and to do so, they need to rely on anonymity and encryption. We found that these impacts of pre-publication exposure of investigations that can trigger cover-ups, the revelation of sources' identities and extra-legal repercussions, which is a bureaucratic way of describing the worst-case scenario for journalists' sources when they're exposed, which can include murder, execution, incarceration, potentially for life. And we know of many stories now where these sorts of eventualities have occurred. Information runs dry if sources are insecure, and the journalists and editors and the lawyers who represent the journalists that we interviewed around the world and surveyed talked about this being a reality, that people are more reluctant, that sources they've cultivated for years are now more concerned about coming forward than they were previously. And then we have the issue of self-censorship. The other factor that newsrooms are confronting around the world, and freelance journalists as well, is the cost of source protection, of responding to the undermining of the legal protections that we have typically been able to rely on in many contexts. The undermining of those has led to the need to upgrade digital security and digital safety at a great cost in newsrooms. The training that's involved is also time-consuming and costly, but I would argue essential, and we'll come back to that later. And also the legal advice. Some of the lawyers we interviewed talked about this being, you know, a growth industry. You know, large fees are being charged in accordance with the work that is needing to be done in terms of advice, pre-publication advice around the world as well. So we've made a range of recommendations, some of which I'm sharing with you for the first time here. The first one to note is an 11-point plan that we're recommending be adopted by member states of UNESCO to try to improve the situation. So it's an assessment tool for measuring the effectiveness of source protection policies and laws in each country, if you like. And that's based on expert interviews with members of the legal community, news organisations, legal counsel, and freedom of expression activists, civil society activists. So we've recommended, as I said, that laws be strengthened and introduced where they don't exist. We think importantly that the laws that relate specifically to source protection need to work in tandem with whistleblower laws, which are typically separate set of laws, but in combination, so where they work in effect together, they are much more powerful as legal tools to defend investigative journalism that's dependent on confidential sources. Also, importantly, these laws need to cover electronic communications, not just the published journalism, not just the analog communications. There are many examples in the study of circumstances in which a hard drive or a mobile phone has not been seen as protected communication as far as source protection laws are concerned, but the notebook is considered to be protected. So this is clearly anachronistic. It's out of step in time and place with the sort of journalism that we are now doing. There's a need to educate journalists, I've mentioned that already, but also civil society actors. And in fact, we now are in a situation where we need to consider, as journalists, as news organisations, actually training sources or training potential sources in secure methods of communication, particularly if we're inviting them to communicate with us, as often we do, whether that's by using a secure Dropbox or other apps that are deemed to be secure. And we think it's time to recognise the need to define acts of journalism as distinct from journalists. That's because where laws do exist to protect journalist sources, often they are narrow and the defence is not available or the protection is not available to journalists who don't work, for example, for major media organisations, who are seen to be non-traditional journalists. So a legal blogger, for example, may not be protected in some of these circumstances. So at this point, I'm going to talk to members of our panel to get their reactions to the study as I've shared the details with you now. And then I want to go to you guys. I want to hear from people in the audience about any experiences that you've had, concerns you've got, issues that you'd like to raise that we can take forward in further research and in consideration of practice. So I'm going to start with you, Marcel. Just thinking about these issues and based on the experience you've had, the very extensive experience you've had working with confidential sources, what do you take away from this study? What resonates with you?
Well, first of all, I would say that actually the existence of the study and the work you did is very important, because everything that raises awareness for the problem helps and is critically important. And this has been quite an endeavor, 121 states. You did service. It's really a great piece of work, and I hope it gets a big display internationally, the results. It resonates certainly with me and remembers me of many situations, especially the points you raised about the need of educating journalists, ourselves, and educating sources, because as a report from the field, I can say, in my experience, a very critical situation usually is the first point of contact you have with the potential source. And there we actually have experienced in the past situations that made it very difficult for us as journalists. Perhaps two examples. Actually, we had one incident where a member of an army being deployed in an actual war zone sent us material without a first notice, sent us in an initial email from his account, from his army account, documents that were actually classified in the first email. So how do you handle such a situation?
How did you respond to that?
Actually, we learned from that lesson that we need something on our homepage and actually ask people not to send us material which is a curious situation to be in, but we felt morally obliged to do so. We actually have guidelines now on our website. We try to educate potential sources how to get in contact and what please not to do. And please, it states, please do not send us via an unencrypted email from your work account material. Another big trap I experience more and more often is social media, actually. Something, again, potential sources, I think, should be educated in, and journalists as well, not only sources. But we had the situation, the awkward situation, that's the other example, of somebody announcing on social media, and I want to keep that anonymous because it was a real incident, announcing to a colleague on social media that he would be sending something in within the next 30 minutes. And of course,
that is something
like a worst case situation if you actually perhaps don't see it and he actually does it, or she, the person involved. So I think there are many lessons to learn and many things to be done. I also want to say that we actually did a big leap forward after the Snowden revelations, because actually many colleagues, and not only at Der Spiegel, have learned that it's substantial to use encryption, not only to protect sources, which is the most important point, of course, but to actually get the stories. You mentioned the last big leak and what the colleagues said happened before the material was sent. I remember, of course, the Snowden case. Actually, Glenn Greenwald almost missed the scoop of his life because he had no public PGP key. And it was only, rather incredible that Snowden, because he wanted to work with Glenn Greenwald, even went so far to do a video tutorial on how to use PGP for Glenn, so that he would start to do so. And we can't expect that from, you know, any other source to go to great lengths. So I think that's benchmark, that's basic right now. But with still lessons to be learned, many things are happening, like crypto parties for journalists and things like that, but it's not enough, and not many enough colleagues actually use encryption, at least. And then why should we use it? And you mentioned it in abstract terms. I want to be a little bit more concrete, perhaps, because you say we need new laws and better laws. What we see is quite the opposite, actually. We see a strategy of deterrence when it comes to the work of journalists and sources. you see a strategy of intimidation, and not only in the US, those are very prominent examples. Obama's aide, the whistleblowers and leakers that got indicted under this arcane espionage act from 1911, those are very prominent examples now, you know, the cases. But we have cases in Germany as well. And Markus Beckedahl will be next up on this stage, so I won't dive into his example with Netzpolitik, but it's worth looking at it because it shows you to what length the general prosecutor in Germany went. And this was clearly a message that has been sent not only to Netzpolitik, the blog, but also to potential sources in the area of national security.
Mm. There's such a complex area where you have so many issues intersecting, as we discussed, that it's very difficult to actually keep on top of this, to track what's happening, let alone to try to activate for, you know, change in this space. I want to go to Heather Brooke, who's joining us via Skype next, if we can. Heather, if you can hear me, I'm interested, as I'm sure the people in the room are, from somebody who has a long history as well as an investigative journalist, how you may have changed your practices or what recommendations you've made to colleagues in the UK and the US where you work, particularly in light of your role consulting to various UK-based investigations into these sorts of issues.
Yeah, hi. Well, first, yeah, I want to echo what Marcel said and really, really thank you for the hard work that I know must have been involved to do this study and to putting this issue on the map, because it is very important. I think one of the things to note is the way technology is changing so quickly as well. So I worked on the WikiLeaks story, and at that point we were actually still communicating via Skype to do a lot of these, to do a lot of our internal communication. And now, of course, we wouldn't do that because it's pretty well known that that's a compromised platform and it can be put under surveillance. And so what one learns to, how one learns to communicate at one point in time can very quickly be of no use in the next investigation. So I think rather it's important to know and be aware as a journalist in technology and also to train sources. But for me, where I think the real fundamental issue is in the law and in policy. And this is why I really like the study, because it is about rebuilding into states' constitutions, into their legal policy, an appreciation of what journalists do, the work they do, and the need for sources to be kept confidential and for journalists to keep sources confidential.
So Heather, are you of the view that investigative journalism is at significant risk as a result of these shifts that we're seeing, that even where there is strong traditional source protection that prevents a journalist under pressure in a court environment from having to or from being obliged to reveal the identity of a source, for example, the way in which that's being undermined, some of the journalists I interviewed, and this is evidence that's emerged in a number of cases in the US as well, that, you know, whether it's state actors or powerful corporations that are able to use the sorts of technology that cut through communications to identify a source, you know, we don't need to rely anymore on prosecution or an attempt to get a source unmasked through the courts is what some journalists are being told by the authorities.
Well, I mean, Britain is sort of an odd country, well, in a lot of ways. It's sort of the world leader in transparency of companies. So, yeah, we have a very open companies register. But also, we're sort of world leaders in all of the wrong ways, because we have this incredibly draconian investigatory powers bill, which is about creating on a legal framework and giving a democratic mandate to mass surveillance. And what we saw, there was a case last June where Amnesty International brought a case to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal in London, and they found out that they had been illegally spied on, and not particularly targeted. It wasn't that GCHQ, which is our sort of signals intelligence agency in Britain, they weren't particularly targeted. They were just hauled in this you know, they were just in the net, the mass net of interception that happens in these bulk surveillance systems. Mm. And the only reason that Amnesty even found out about it is because the information was kept too long. It didn't even seem to be a problem, the fact that it was kept in the first place, which for me is an issue. And I think for most people that believe in that we need to have some rights to privacy to have a properly functioning democracy. So there's the issue that if you have these mass surveillance systems, it doesn't give any special protection for anyone. And now in Britain, some politicians are finding this to be really uncomfortable because they think, well, hang on, does this mean that all members of parliament are also caught in this net? And when it comes to them, they think this is an outrage. And so they want a special carve out for themselves. Mm. But there is no, at the moment, special carve out for journalists or lawyers or other people that have a very important need for confidentiality.
Mm. And often I hear from journalists and civil society activists that it's really hard to advocate for journalists' rights because of the absence of trust, which is a theme we've heard about at this conference in professional journalism, which I think is rather tragic and an indication that we have a lot more work to do with regard to reinforcing the importance of journalism in a democratic context. Dan, can I come to you now? What's your view? Is there a future for investigative journalism dependent on confidential sources, particularly, say, at the pointy end we might describe as national security reporting exists?
It's certainly going to get much harder to do. I wanted to also respond to your initial study report. In your first bullet point, you talked about these legal rights and methods being under significant strain. And I think that was very diplomatic language. I would use the word under significant attack, which I think is probably not going to pass muster with the director general of your organization, but that is what's going on. And this is a concerted, sustained attack on journalism, made possible by technology and determination by governments and others that they should have rights to privacy and action that others don't, and that they should have the absolute right to know what anyone says or does in the digital world at any time, end of story. And that's led to some quite extraordinary push by governments to bend the law where possible, break it if necessary, be indifferent to it in general. So there are still a lot of good laws, but they're being sort of wildly flouted by people in authority. Something that Marcel said, I want to expand on a bit, I think, and by the way, I am in awe of the work that Der Spiegel and others have done. This is extraordinarily great stuff, and we desperately need more of it. So the notion of helping our sources understand what the risks are is crucial. I would go beyond that to say that we have to help the public in general understand what the risks are to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, basic freedoms in this sustained attack that's taking place. It's not just on journalists, it's on all of us. So educate sources by all means, but my if I were planning how to do it, I would say let's educate everybody if possible and hope that the sources are part of it, with special attention to people who are in possession or have access to documents and other material that are incredibly radioactive for their careers or lives. I have been thinking for a long time that journalists should be leading the the activism in this regard for freedom of expression and these other freedoms, and I hope that we will over time. It's been a long time since I was doing investigative reporting, and what I had to deal with was nothing. By the way, you mentioned PGP, and in the late 1990s, I installed PGP on my computer, and a man named Phil Zimmerman came down to my office to help me do it, and he's the guy who invented PGP. And
it's not bad as assistance goes.
So
better than a tutorial.
And it was really difficult. It was difficult, and even Phil had some issues in getting it onto my computer. What was fun was that 15, if not fun, wrong word, it was daunting that more than 15 years later, a couple of years ago, at a key signing party with people who were going to sign each other's cryptographic keys, and we were installing GPG, the newer version of it, open source version, on people's computers, and I realized it was not significantly easier than it had been 15 years earlier, which tells you a lot about progress we have to make. So,
and that's one of the issues that keeps coming up, actually.
Yeah, and so those are some of the things. I think to answer your initial question, it's going to be incredibly difficult to do national security journalism in the future, but we have to get better laws. It's going to be a political as well as technological answer.
I'd like to come to the audience now. Do we have any comments or questions either about the study as it's been briefly outlined to you or some of your own experiences or concerns in this area of journalism that's dependent on confidential sources?
I work for the Times in London. I run a data investigations team there, and my experience has been that a lot of journalists in the newsroom don't fully understand their digital footprint. So they won't understand that, you know, you're on your IP address of your news organization and a source has given you a password to their login of their computer, and next thing you know, you've created this whole digital footprint that leads you back to the data you're accessing or the information you're accessing or whatever it is. I was just wondering from the panel just what your experience is and what you believe needs to be done to educate journalists, the public, whatever it is, about how we go about securing that, the protection of journalists, the protection of sources, because it is an increasingly important area, not just in national security cases, but just everyday journalism, because now that can definitely be traced back and people can find and reveal. Governments are quite good at going back and finding out how their whistleblower blew the whistle.
Exactly. Indeed, and I might just respond briefly and then go to my colleagues both on Skype and sitting here. I know, Marcel, you've had some experience in this specifically. I now work for Fairfax Media, which is one of the biggest, or the biggest digital publisher in Australia, but has an incredibly long history. Sydney Morning Herald is one of its publications, and it started in, you know, 1830-ish. So it's an old newspaper, very reputable, incredible newspaper with a staggering investigations team in terms of its success. You know, very successful investigations team, and at its sister paper, The Age, as well. We are in a situation where we have just recognised, and one of the reasons I was hired was actually to deal with source protection education. So I now am in charge of editorial capability, but that includes source protection. So at the industry level in my own kind of corner of the world, it's increasingly being recognised that this is a problem and that journalists do need to be educated. For me, the issue of awareness is the first step. So we're talking about, excuse my French as we say, but doing holy shit seminars where we actually go, this is real, here are some examples of breaches, these are the consequences in terms of death or imprisonment at the sharp end, and here are the other consequences in terms of reputation and job loss that we need to be aware of. And I believe that we need to have a hierarchy of... Well, we have a hierarchy of risk. We also need to have a hierarchical approach to dealing with those levels of risk. So my starting point is that there needs to be a basic level of awareness and digital security being practiced, whether it's by the fashion reporter or the sports reporter, both of whom could be recipients of extraordinary information in the form of, say, organized crime connections to the fashion industry, or, you know, corruption at the Olympics. In the case of the sports journalists, who knows, you know, what will be revealed. And there is, and this is not just within Fairfax, my news organisation, but there is broadly, based on this research, still a lack of awareness and a tendency to sort of disregard this as the concern of just your national security reporters, when we need to start at a much more basic level. I might go to you first, Marcel, because that example, sorry, I don't know your name. Megan's example of leaving a footprint is a classic one, you know.
Absolutely, and I had my holy shit moment, if I can repeat what you just said, with exactly such an example several years ago. It was in the early 2000s when we did research on a company, actually, and we did what we usually do and really scraped the website for the bios of the management, of the business reports, obviously, and everything. And when we thought we were ready to contact the company, it was not a big company, I have to say. It was a company selling surveillance gear, a private company. They actually reacted with one sentence, a revealing sentence that probably wouldn't happen right now, nowadays, but the person on the other end of the line said, "We've expected your call." And that was something that, you know, of course, brought me to the question, oh, that's interesting, how comes? And the person actually was in a boasting mood, obviously, and said, well, we saw what you did with our website. So that was actually, of course, a big mistake on the part of the person I've been talking to. They didn't know that it was me personally, but it was the IP trail you just mentioned, of course, and they were logging IPs. And they were not the only ones. Actually, German ministries, the Secretary of Justice, actually, website, and other law enforcement websites, they log IP traffic, and they locked IP traffic as well. They even use it as a honey trap in certain instances, law enforcement does, if they pull up fugitive sites and stuff like this. So again, it's a question of awareness, and it's actually a problem that has not so much to do with perhaps source protection than protection of your own work, and that is obviously something journalists would adopt perhaps more easily because it is something everybody can understand, and it's pretty easy to mitigate using VPNs, using services like Tor and others. So this is something you can have internal trainings, and that of course is another answer to your question. And yes, there is a certain possibility that you will be ridiculed. Yes, there are colleagues that would say, oh, you know, she's making herself perhaps a little important with the stuff she researches. You won't need that kind of protection. But that are the obstacles you have to actually face. And I'm pretty sure you will, on the other hand, have many colleagues that are very interested and many colleagues that would like to adopt. And of course, it's a good idea to actually raise the issue not only with colleagues, but with your IT department and probably with your editors.
Heather, I might come to you next as the person on Skype, and then I'll get to you, Dan.
Sure.
You also teach journalism. Is this something that you're dealing with in a classroom context? Are people trying to equip future journalists with the skills necessary and the awareness necessary to undertake journalism based on confidential source information?
Yeah, it's definitely part of the investigative journalism modules that we teach at City University. I do think it's probably about time it's spread across to other parts of journalism, you know, everyday news. Because one of the first things that we talk about in this particular lesson about security for journalists and their sources is it's not just about your source. It's not even just about you. It's about all of your devices. And where those devices are, you could lose them. Think about all the information that is on that device and the need for it to be encrypted and protected for all sorts of reasons. And so it is very important that as a young journalist, you understand that you have a responsibility to your source to keep them safe. And it doesn't just mean that you're doing, you're a national security reporter. You could be covering the local council. You could be covering of the police department. You just have to do a risk assessment about who well, who might be interested in your information? Who might be interested in interfering with your story? And also, what would the damage be if your information was lost or stolen or hacked into? And so then you think about what are the precautions that you need to take. And it could be just as simple as making sure that you have all of your devices encrypted, so that if you lose them on a train or something like that, that you're not giving away all of your information, your story drafts, all of your source material that was behind that article. So that's really what we do. That's a kind of sort of basic primer. And I feel like that's really where most journalists need to start out, is thinking about themselves, their sources, and their devices. And and then you get into communication and being on the web. I was just on the thing about the IP tracking. There's a very funny Twitter feed that posts up any time Wikipedia is edited by somebody from inside the House of Parliament, because there's an IP address associated with the British House of the British Parliament. And so this is a very quick way for MPs to understand about IP tracking, because they can then, you get a whole list on Twitter about when somebody from inside Parliament's edited their Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, I think Heather just raised a really important point, because it's not only about technology when we talk about operational security for journalists. It's pretty basic stuff, actually. Mm. It's the question of not leaving your computer at the office without, you know, you better take it with you, you better have a safe. USB sticks, unencrypted, are a big danger. So it's not only about Tor and Tails, and then it can be pretty basic rules like strong passwords you can follow and have a better protection.
So Dan, let's come to you. What's
how many of you out here click on attachments in email? Just open them up. Anybody?
Only one person, two people.
A couple of you.
Prepared to admit it.
Yeah, I'd encourage you to never do that, like ever.
They never open anything, or they download first and then put it through AI.
I mean, find out if it's from someone you know or it looks to be. Call them up and ask them, "Did you send me something just now?" There's still no 100% protection. I want to say more about what Heather said there, and in the security community, they have a term that they call threat model. Basically, it means, what are you worried about? What's the scenario that, you know, that you're foreseeing as a possibility? Protect against that as best you can. So it's different. It's a different threat model for me, because I'm not doing investigative reporting anymore, much less national security. You know, my chief worries these days are, you know, whether my neighbor's teenage son might try to hack our Wi-Fi at home and do weird stuff, or whether script kiddies on the internet are gonna, you know, probe various ports and find vulnerabilities, things like that. Whereas in a journalism situation, there's a different model, a different threat model to consider and to protect against. We don't have a formal program at my school of teaching internet digital security. I have been lobbying for one. I'd make it part of the course I teach. I do think that there are a lot of good resources now, even if you're not getting formal training. The Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, Electronic Frontier Foundation, a number of people have pretty good guides to being safer. And I recommend that as a start if you don't get formal training. But we clearly have to step this up in a pretty significant way.
How many of you, working for news organizations or working as freelance reporters, have had training in the protection of sources or digital safety training? Two of you. How many of you are working in that space, being a reporter, being a journalist, who have not had that sort of training?
so about 50% of you. So one of the things that we found in the context of research is that although awareness is increasing, that the training and support for improved practices is not necessarily increasing. So certainly that's what we're trying to address at my company at the moment at Fairfax. I'm also was a journalism academic, and I'm still a fellow at a university in Australia called the University of Wollongong, and we're talking about doing similar things to what Dan's suggesting, drawing on this research and trying to reboot education so that there is, among graduates, a basic awareness. But many journalists who have not been through journalism schools will not benefit from that kind of rebooting. And so we really do need to do this, I think, at the industry coalface. One of the conclusions I've come to is that within news organisations, and I'm speaking here about larger news organisations where there's capability to do this, there needs to be collaboration. I'm sure there'll be nods of agreement, but we still often work in silos in news organisations. We are not necessarily collaborating with the IT security people in our news organisations. We are not necessarily talking one newsroom to another newsroom about the skills that have developed or the tools that are being trialled. The training division doesn't necessarily know that it's even an issue until there's a crisis. The safety area, so if you have a person responsible for safety, often that's considered to be physical safety, and it comes as a shock to them when they have to deal with the consequences of a breach of journalistic communications that leads to a very heightened physical risk to a source or to a journalist. So I think we need to bring all of these elements within news organisations together to collaborate on developing training that creates a situation where the journalist is aware and has skills in place, but when there is a problem, they can go to the IT division to get support without being, you know, shunted away and told, no, we don't support that application, for example. What do you think about that?
Do you think your IT department is better at their job than the people at Mossback Fonseca in Panama City? You know, you should hope they are, but I'd be willing to bet there's a lot of journalism email to be had at any moment.
We're even seeing that in discovery, in our cases related to defamation, for example, where emails between journalists in a newsroom, in a very traditional sense, are being revealed in our context. Marcel, what are your tips, if I can put you on the spot, the three things that you would recommend journalists do in their daily work, in their communications with sources, to increase the security of those communications?
Educate yourself. Be creative. Do not only trust technology, but try to be creative. Change patterns of behavior. Try to educate sources, or at least talk to your editors that they would take decisions to do so. And then try to train colleagues or talk to colleagues about your problems and your learnings. That would be the three things.
I'll say again what I said earlier. I think journalists need to become the activist leaders in helping their audiences and the public understand why freedom of expression needs protection. They should be activists for getting better laws. And in general, if we don't do this, we're just inviting the worst. So it's time to get going.